Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport in association with LACA. Bicycle insurance powered by the community.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show from Eurosport, the home of cycling. I'm Graham Wargoss, and joining me, I'm delighted to say, is two-time Paris-Roubaix winner, Sean Kelly. Welcome, Sean.
Hello.
And, of course, the man who finished ninth in the 2014 edition, Bradley Wiggins.
Hi.
We've made some calculations. We've found the budget for a third guest, I'm very happy to say. This week we've got the bonification of Matt Stevens.
Yeah, he's already on the cheap, isn't he?
Matt, welcome back. We had such a good time with you last time.
Thanks very much.
We're delighted to have you back.
Detention at Eurosport.
It is a little bit. I could have been home a while ago, but now I'm here. But that's great. It's great to be back.
Well, yes, we've kept you both behind after Paris-Roubaix. You've done a monster shift, both of you, today, actually. Sean was in for 10 a.m. this morning. We will come to that, the game of stones. But before we do, I want to just touch on another story as old as time, if you will, or it certainly feels like it at this point. Brad, straight in with the headlines. Chris Froome has said this week that he struggled to trust you in the 2012 Tour de France after racing the Vuelta with you. So he's been on Nico Rosberg's podcast, yeah. the former Mercedes driver, obviously. Clearly what they've tried to do is draw a comparison between Rosberg and Hamilton at Mercedes and yourself and Froome at Sky, and how team orders one man eventually in team sport has to be subservient to the other. So Froome said, the difficult part for me was trusting him as the leader, so him being you, Brad, given that in the last big race, he won't say at the time, the Vuelta a España, I'd gone there to support him and he fell apart in the last few days. Going into the Tour de France, I had this in my mind. I was thinking, I'm doing a job for this guy, but if he falls apart in the last few days, I need to be in the position to take over again.
I wish you'd have told me. But no, I mean, that's Chris's opinion. As I said, I spoke last few weeks about here. You know, that's the world we're all in. Maybe I wasn't the best communicator at the time. The year I had a bad couple of days towards the end of the Vuelta, I'd broken collarbone 6 weeks earlier. I still had a plate in. I couldn't really get out of the saddle properly. I didn't expect to be in that position. And to be honest, I think if Chris is being honest as well, he didn't expect to be. He couldn't scratch his ass before that point and found himself second in the Vuelta with a week to go. And at the start of the race, Dave's coming to me saying, I don't think we're going to sign him next year. What do you think, Brad? And I said, well, he's proved himself here in the team time trust. I think you should keep him. You know, we know he's got an engine, and here he is now. So I think, you know, that's the way teams work. It's all a bit incestuous, and no one really communicates. I'll be the first to admit I wasn't the best team leader in the world, so communication wasn't my strong point. And we found ourselves second and third going into the last couple of days of the Vuelta a España, and it was his, you know, the point for him that leaped his career forward, really, and gave him the confidence to do what he did. But, I mean, as I say, you know, I'm not going to sit here and slag him off because, you know, I think he's a great athlete and this, that and the other, but that's the world you're in at that time, and, you know, I take responsibility for it as well, but it is what it is.
Given that that 2012 tour was so time trial heavy and it was a course absolutely suited to you, which is obviously a huge reason why Sky made you the main man for that tour, is he being a little bit unfair, you know, given that you were so dominant in the TTs?
Well, that year I hadn't lost a race either. Yeah. I did win Paris-Nice, Romandy, Dauphiné. I hadn't lost a time trial all year, and I was leading the tour by 3 minutes going into the last couple of days with a 55 kilometre time trial. There was no signs I was going to crack. I hadn't cracked all year. I didn't have a broken collarbone, and I was, so, you know, maybe, yeah, I mean, I don't want to get myself in too much trouble because you know what the media are like, but that was it, really. I did win, didn't I? It's all ifs and buts, isn't it? But he's gone on to win four since and could potentially win five this year. So
Matt, what's your take on this one?
I think it's a matter of semantics, just how your interpretation of the word trust. It's trusting, is he talking about trusting Brad in terms of his doing things behind his back or not telling him about his condition, or is it just didn't trust Brad that he could hold out physically, which is a completely different kettle of fish. If you don't trust somebody because you think they're going to lie and deceive you, then it's very, very different than actually trusting somebody. Not, you know, I don't trust you. I don't think you, you know, you capitulated at the end of the Vuelta. That's what he said. You know, it's the matter of what does he mean by trust. I think if he means trust as in terms of not trusting Bradley as a person, that's a point of view. It could be that he didn't trust him lasting out in a Grand Tour, and I suppose I guess I see his point, but I guess it's just the interpretation of trust,
but as a again, we were both in that kitchen of kind of both extremely competitive, both wanting to win. He was fighting for his life for a contract at that time. Yeah. I think at the time he had one option on the table because we were rooming together, and he was talking about going to Garmin, Cannondale, Chipotle, whatever they were at the time. And in the end, he got second, and Dave signed him up and saw him, you know, as his cash cow for the next few years. But this is the nature of athletes at that level. We're all a bit insecure and always looking over each other's backs and things. And, you know, that environment was sort of created a little bit of Sky as well, the competitiveness there from Dave, and almost still is, really. And it works somehow. It somehow works by playing all these big stars off against each other. And there is an element of trust between riders, and there has to be, but I wouldn't say they'd bet their houses on it, you know. Well, we were watching the Roubaix running today, and we were talking about Gilbert. Does he keep it running, or does he wait for Yves Lampaert, which is my chance to win Roubaix? You know, so there is that sort of insecurity at sport at that level, particularly in cycling, and it's all this big happy family till there's a race on the line. And, you know, but that's Chris's opinion. I mean, you know, it is what it is. I don't claim to be the same person I am now that I was sat in the Vuelta. You know, I was a bit of a, as I said the last few weeks, you know, I used to be a bit of a I was a bit of a then. That's why I won the tour. But, you know, I can't completely detach from that person now, and I don't recognise any of myself as I am now. But that's his opinion. It might be an insecure opinion, it might not, you know, but that's the way he feels. And potentially that might be why he's made such a good career since.
Sean, you're in a similar situation?
Adrie van der Poel, dear. Do you remember that one?
Yes, well, there was a number of times. Well, you know, in cycling, it's difficult to trust somebody when you're in a team and you're fighting for the same objective, the same win. And, you know, on a bike, you're going uphill, you're going downhill. You know, you can always say, well, I thought you were there, I thought you were following me, I didn't think you were getting dropped, there's all of that to it. So it's difficult to trust anybody. And I know from my time in my career of cycling, yes, it's you always have to be careful trusting riders. When it comes to the very important moment and that opportunity, that win is there to take, and it's between your two riders of the same team, I think you can never trust somebody 100%.
Yeah, but if you also watch at the Tour last year, it was only at the 11th knock-ins. Froome was still trying to win that race in the Tour de France, you know. And there's an element of him thinking, well, I've won the Tour four times. You know, is Geraint going to last up this last mountain, or are we going to see... So, and I think Geraint said it in his book, didn't he, that in some of the meetings, he was like, what the hell's going on here, you know? Are we riding for me, or are we riding for Chris? You know, what's going on? So even at that level at Sky, with all the happiness that's projected from that team, there's still this insecurity where G's writing in a book further down the line that I wasn't sure what was going on, you know? It's that kind of... But that's what it's like, cycling. Everyone wants to win. It's that competitive environment.
Talking of a competitive environment then, today's big race, the biggest one-day race of the season, Paris-Roubaix. We've assembled our own Pave Appreciation Society. 257 kilometres of road covered, 29 cobbled sections, 55 kilometres of Pave in total. It was a real strongman finish from Philippe Gilbert and Niels Pollitt, the two men who came into the Velodrome first going for the win. It was Gilbert who had the power in the end to take Pollitt in the sprint. The first Belgian to win a cobbled race all season. This is how it went.
Here goes Gilbert! Gilbert's driving for five! He's out, he has the gap, but can Pollitt come around him? Gilbert looking to the finish! Gilbert's going to do it! It's fantastic! Philippe Gilbert! Five-star Phil does it! And a Koenig Quickstep are winners of Paris-Roubaix again!
Brad, it's a horrible race to ride, but it's the one everyone wants to win.
It isn't. I wouldn't say it's a horrible race to ride. I used to love riding it. The only risk in it is the amount of crashes, the amount of jostling you have to do for every sector right from the start. You know, it's like a bunch. It's like the last 10-15k of a bunch sprint into every sector. So from that point, you're always concentrating. So it doesn't feel horrible at the time because you're so focused on what you're doing. Mm. Other races I found a lot more horrible, like Liège and things like that, where every left, right, and Amstel Gold is an uphill or something like that. Roubaix was a dream to ride. It was a beautiful race. And the 6-7 hours you're out there, it goes so quick once you get through the first sector, you know, that 150k from the first sector to the finish, before you know it, it's all done and dusted. I actually, one of the most enjoyable races. There's always the risk you'll crash and really hurt yourself if you do. But it's a great race to ride, and obviously, Sean, you've won it twice, you can tell.
How many times did you ride it?
About 9 times in total.
Oh, that's good going. Yeah, it was a race that you can
perform. But I never rode it in the wet. That was tough. I think that changes the whole aspect.
Well, it does change a lot, but still, you know, it's a race that if you have the qualities to win it, well, then, you know, it's something that it's a big objective for you. But for me, it was never a nice race to ride, and I was never looking forward to it, you know, the days before. although, you know, some of the years I was the one of the big favourites. The other races, like Liège, I would prefer, and I wasn't great at climbing. I always struggled a bit, but it's more of a clean race. Liège, Tour of Lombardy, if you're good, you just sit there, you follow, and it's elimination through the back door. But in the Paris-Roubaix, you know, there's so much going on, as Brad said, you know, the crashes. And you can be so good, and in the end, you know, you can be in a great position 20, 25 kilometres out, a mechanic at the wrong time, you know, it can just take you out of the equation, take you out of, you know, the chance of winning it. So all of that is that pressure there, that just thinking about that, but also the crashes and, you know, all that goes on and the fighting that goes on. You know, you have to fight to get onto the fourth section of cobbles. You get rid of a lot of the big Belgians. Then they come back on the asphalt road. You have to fight on the second section, the third section, the fourth section. And you have, if you have dry conditions, you have to do that so many times. You know, and it is a very stressful race. So for me, it wasn't one of the races that I like. But of course, yes, if you feel you can win it, well, then you have to get in there and you have to, you know, fight it with them.
It's quite an emotional day today, Matt.
Yeah, I mean,
as ever, really.
Yeah, I mean, my pro tenure was quite a short one, and I've never ridden that race, but it doesn't mean I can't be equally in love with it. You know, as a kid growing up, my dad introduced me to cycling, and it is one of the races, that single day races, along with the World Championships, that has, you know, an incredible degree of emotion to it. And as Gilbert crossed the line and put his arms up, you could see it in his face. It was, you know, that classic win number five. He's never won Roubaix before, of course. And then the moment when Lefebvre was just, it was like Gilbert for a moment was his son. He held him quite tenderly. And Lefebvre is an old school, you know, I don't agree with everything Lefebvre says, but there was a real kindness. And Gilbert is towards, he's in the autumn of his career, but he rode, you know, one of the races of his life today. He rode it smart and he was strong as well. And it all fell in place. And because of all that, because of his age and because he's been striving for this fifth monument win, and for the first time it's Paris-Roubaix. And of course, the added pressure that no Belgian had won a cobbled race this year at all. The pressure on him was immense. So all those factors contribute and make it so, so beautiful. I've never ridden it, but I kind of ride it in a different way as a commentator, trying to get those stories across. It's amazing. It's a privilege.
Phil, you know, towards the end of BMC was kind of almost at an end of his career, really. I think he'd sort of run out of motivation. And Patrick, in some ways, almost resurrected his career. He's won the two biggest races of his career in Tour of Flanders and Roubaix towards the back end of his career.
Well, he made him hungry again, I think, because he had quite a modest contract, and it was a win-based contract. And that first year at Quickstep, he couldn't stop winning, could he?
No.
You know, and he's kept that kind of hunger, and that's clearly what Lefebvre does on a relatively limited budget when you compare it to some of the big-hitting, you know, big-money corporate world tour teams.
I'm not sure if it's all about money, because Philippe Gilbert, the position he's in at the moment financially, that's not what makes him hungry. That's not what drives him. It's just the environment in the team, you know, all of that, the way they work with in the Duconi Quickstep. And they seem to be able to, you know, motivate each other within the team, I suppose, all that personnel. They work so well together. And then the riders, there's the morale there, and the camaraderie between the riders is great. And I think that's what is...
Yeah, and the likes of Brian Holm as well, don't they have to take
the credit? Yes,
Wilfred Peters,
They play a very big part. And, you know, if you've got that, you know, then you get motivated, and, you know, you set these targets. And that's what Philippe Gilbert have done, setting the target to win a Roubaix. And last year, when he won the Tour of Flanders, I said, well, you know, if you can't hold the form, you definitely can win a Roubaix, because if you win a Flanders like you did last year, he's capable of winning a Roubaix. And you could see that, you know, so emotional. And that is Roubaix. You know, even though you've won so many monuments, you know, World Championship, like when you win the big ones, you're a grown-up person, you're plus 30 years of age, but you're like a child when you win those events. Like, you get so emotional. And I was pretty much written off at the end of my career, and I managed to win a Milan-San Remo.
Four in the top 10 for de Koninck today. So Lampaert filling out the podium, and then Florian Senechal in sixth, and Stibar coming in 8th. I mean, it's a race that you really felt like de Koninck went full gas for today. I mean, they've been dominant in the one-day classics all season, really.
They've just got strength in depth, like Sean was saying. That there's something special going on in that team, that they can motivate the riders. They clearly, and most importantly, they not just communicate before a race, they have a plan. But because they've got such depth, and they clearly communicate, they don't get it right all the time, but generally speaking, they communicate well on the road, and they've got everything covered. And that's key. Communicating, knowing your strengths and weaknesses, and having the kind of strength on the road to make decisions on the fly. You need people who are intelligent on the bikes as well as strong. I don't know what you think.
Well, no, I mean, I think it's also that they're such a family orientated team. I mean, I saw them doing the recon during the week, and they had Johan Museo out with them, and Tom Boonen, two ex-winners, two ex-Quickstep riders. And they kind of come back to the team and ride with them. And you can imagine for the likes of Yves Lampaert and that, riding along with Museo and Tom Boonen and that, and them talking about certain sectors that they've won the race on, etc. It just gives that little bit extra, a bit of a lift, really. And I think that's what Patrick does so well.
And they ride with their head. If you look at Quickstep today, they were there the first 100 kilometres. They had men who were in the front watching for the breakaways, not allowing too much of a big breakaway to get away, not allowing the riders, the other favourites, to get teammates into that breakaway. And then you do not see the likes of Philippe Gilbert, Stibar, Lampard. We did not see a lot of him. You know, you do not see the nose. And that's what you've got to do. You do not put your nose in the wind for the first 130 kilometres and then appear when it's the moment. Mm. And they, you know, they ride intelligently. When you look at AGTR today, I don't know what they were trying to do. You know, they were riding on the front there, and we see, you know, some of the riders. Nason was riding on the front. Van den Berg, he was pulling on the front. 130 kilometres out, what's he at? Like, who do they think they are? They just have to wait and play the card and play the tactic. But, you know, I don't understand the tactic. And from the director sportive point of view as well, I don't understand why they don't say race radio. OK, guys, stop. Just sit in the group and wait, and we'll wait until the race really starts.
I think we have to mention last year's winner as well, chaps, Peter Sagan. He's, who sort of seemed to run out of gas. He's at 30k's out, and he's in that final shake-up. How did you see it, Brad?
Well, he looked about 50k out on Monson Pavel. You know, he looked like he was going to ride away with this like he did last year. I was thinking he was going to end up attacking on Monson Pavel, and he just seemed to sort of disintegrate from that point on, really. Either he did too much work on the front, either he was too confident, or he didn't eat enough from that point on. But I mean, it was pretty rapid once he did go. You know, it was quite an explosion, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether he's just in the right condition, but you know, clearly if he wasn't in top form, he's still got that, you know, he's still one of those riders who liked bike racing, you know. Although he wasn't at 100%, he just got himself in the right position, and up to a point looked good, but then with 30k to go, he completely capitulated. I think it's the nearest that I think I've seen recently with Sagan in particular, that he actually, we use the word bonk, but that doesn't actually happen very often. And I think he just blew. You could see he was almost seeing stars, and but managed to hold on to fifth place, so still very respectable. By anybody's standards, that's a good ride, but by his own, it's not so good. But it's good to see him, even though he's not on top form racing. I don't know what you think, Sean. But
yes, well, I think he tried to bluff it a bit today. When, you know, when we went into the Monzon Pavel, when it really got serious, and the, you know, the real difficult part of the race with Gilbert attacking, and then we see Yves Lampard right in the front. I think Sagan was, you know, starting to feel the fatigue was setting in, but he tried to play the card. The very minute Gilbert attacked immediately in the wheel, but yeah, it was still a long ways out, and he paid for those efforts, and maybe I didn't eat enough. But that is Paris-Roubaix. We see Niels Pollitt looked like he was in difficulty 25 kilometres out. He seemed to be losing contact with that breakaway of six, and then he turned around and, you know, was one of the stronger ones in the end.
Found another gear.
He was the one that attacked, and Gilbert went across to him on the penultimate sector of Pavé, you know. So
it's all about getting the gels.
I want to mention Ilio Kayser as well, who hit a road sign. It looked like a hell of a smash up. Yeah. So we understand that he's okay. I mean, it looked quite nasty. But on that note, and particularly because you've joined us today, Sean, I wanted to talk about the worst injury that each of you has ridden on with.
I was pretty lucky, actually. Yeah. I mean, I had a broken wrist. I rode at the World Championships. I rode the Team Pursuit final with a broken wrist in whenever it was, 2001. That was probably the worst I ever had.
Matt,
the riding on bit, that made me think again, because I've had broken a lot of bones.
The Giro, no? 2000?
I think it's got to be. I end up, yeah, come off on a descent on stage two of the Giro after decking it previously the same day. Riders were off everywhere. It was so slippy. But anyway, came off in this town on a bend and end up in the ambulance because I couldn't move both my knees. The way I'd come down, I'd slammed the top tube on both knees. Eventually got out of the ambulance because it was my first Grand Tour and I thought it might be my last. So I got out and got on my bike, holding on the side of the car, and I couldn't actually pedal. So I had to use my hands to force my knees down to get pedaling again. And then I just soldiered on, basically. It was just like damage limitation every day. You know, you have a team meeting normally to look at how you win the stage. But for us, Sean Yates was saying, right, here's the profile. This is going to be roughly the time. So this is the time. This is the time cut. So my day in the mountains was basically making sure I finished in the time cut, bandaged up. Yeah, and I had a couple of steroid injections from the race doctor to keep me going. But it was grim.
Sean, you took the leader's jersey in the time trial on stage 18 of the Vuelta a España in 1987. Then what happened?
Well, I had the problem. I had a boil on my bottom for a number of days before that time trial.
Is it still there?
No, thank God. And it was just getting more painful as the days went on. And, you know, when you're sitting on the saddle every day for four and a half hours, maybe 5 hours, it doesn't get a chance, you know, to heal. And, I went to the time trial and then took the race leader's jersey. But the following day, it was just too painful to go on. and had to abandon with the race leader's jersey on my back. And yeah, that was a big disappointment because, you know, I had had been fighting for almost 3 weeks. We were getting to the end of the race, and you know, I was pretty much in line to win it. But having to go to the race like that, having to abandon it, was not alone the boil being sore, but it was also a sore one to have to leave the race.
The first time I came to interview you at the Tour of the Alps, I'd waited all afternoon because you'd been out on a recce.
Yeah.
And then I waited all evening and I just thought I wasn't going to get the interview. I was going to have to go home, tell my editor, no, sorry, didn't get to speak to him. And you eventually walked in, still in your Lycra at like 9 o'clock at night. And I was like, oh, he's here. I'm actually going to be able to get this interview. And I was just so, I was so pleased you'd eventually turned up. Yeah. I went, oh, Brad, how are you? And you just looked at me like, you know, proper death stare, and you went, I'm rough as mate.
No, I'd had a boil or something, and I think the doctor had had to lance it off, and I'd had these really strong antibiotics to kill off any infection pre-Giro, and they just wiped me out completely, and we were doing the recon for the Giro at that time. But they gave you the interview, though, didn't I?
You did, yeah. So, yeah, thank you for that. Right, well, more to come on the Bradley Wiggins Show right after this.
In 2019, cycling fans across Europe will be able to watch over 30 UCI World Tour events live on Eurosport and Eurosport Player, available on the app and online via eurosport.co.uk. Eurosport Player also allows viewers to catch up and relive all the action on demand. Eurosport will bring fans unrivaled expertise and analysis from all the best moments of the 2019 season.
Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport in association with Lacquer. Chaps, the Tour of the Basque Country then. Sean, a race you won three times in your career. This year was Astana's Ion Itzaguirre taking the GC ahead of Dan Martin, your countryman, of course, and Bora Hansgrohe's Emmanuel Buchmann in third. What have we learned, Sean, from this year's edition?
Well, I suppose we've learned you can get horrible weather in Basque Country, as we see in the race this year. It was just rain for the first number of days. And yeah, they never fail with these super steep ramps in the Basque Country. It was always there.
Savage, isn't it?
It's savage stuff, and they seem to be just finding more of them. But what a race it was. And, you know, Bora, they had such a great race, and they looked so dominant, you know, with Schachmann in the beginning and then with Buchmann. It looked like they had the race wrapped up, you know, easily. And then the final stage, they seemed to lose control. I didn't really watch it all, but I was surprised when I heard Ion Izaguirre actually managed to, you know, knock him off the leaderboard or the race leadership and win the race.
Well, Adam Yates took the final stage, finished in the top 10 overall. He seems like he's in a good place, Brad.
Yeah, we were talking about him the last few weeks, didn't we, with Catalunya and stuff. And, you know, he's maybe petering out now, and Simon's now going to take over the mantle as we go into the sort of Giro prep and the Giro itself. But fifth in the Basque Country still, and obviously another stage win to this win tally this season.
Maximilian Schachmann, Bora, took three stages, Matt. We've been impressed with him so far this season. He's built on his form from Catalunya.
Yeah, the lad's a motorbike. I mean, it's incredible. Just that breakthrough stage win in the Giro last year opened a lot of people's eyes. Bit of a surprise move from Quickstep over to the German team. That win the other week in Catalunya when he held off the bunch, you know, it looked like it was one of those game over things. The bunch were closing and held the bunch off for 20k on his own. Insane. It was very, very talented bike rider. Then to win the opening time trial, beating riders like Alaphilippe, and then to win two road stages in pretty atrocious conditions just shows how versatile and how adaptable that young rider is. He really is a talent. But as Sean said, Buchmann then won another stage to four stage wins, went into the lead, and then to lose it all on the final stage. Four stage wins and three riders in the top 10. I don't know, management might want to look at that one a little bit, but again, you know how consistent Astana have been. I mean, they've had, I think that might make them 22 wins in total this year. They're probably equal, I think, on Quickstep, thereabouts. But yeah, he is a real talent.
Shachmann be a dark horse for the Tour?
He just needs to learn to climb a bit better in the high mountains. It was always a plan for Buchmann to take over because they were a bit worried about the penultimate stage of the Basque Country, because they had some really high mountains, well, some high climbs, and he did capitulate on the high climbs. Maybe in the next couple of years, but not right now, I don't think. I just think he needs to learn to climb better in the high mountains, but he could be one to watch in the Ardennes, no doubt about it.
Another man who showed a glimpse of form, particularly on that opening individual time trial stage, was Geraint Thomas. Finished in the top 10. He subsequently crashed hard. That's his last race in Team Sky colours. Is he showing the form that might win him the Tour or make him a... Because he will go in as one of the favourites after last year?
Well, I think he's struggling a bit. the races that he's taken part in, he doesn't seem to be at the level you would expect him to be, and I think not at the level that he would like to be at. But there's still, you know, a bit of time to get that for the tour. But it's probably a little bit of concerning times for him, because he would prefer to be in a little bit better shape at this moment. But he just have to continue on working and keep the head down, as they say, and it should come around.
Brad, put yourself in G's shoes right now.
Well, he's normally quite good at coming back from setbacks, G. I mean, I remember he crashed out in the Giro a few years ago and came back and won the prologue of the Tour. But he's normally riding on quite high level of fitness. And so if something happens, he can then, it doesn't take much to get back to where he is. And he keeps himself in good shape all year. I think the difference this year is, having won the Tour, his life's been tipped upside down pretty much, in the sense that he's now famous. He's now one of the favourites for the Tour this year. And so everything he does is observed, and we're always watching, and everyone's watching, and everything is questioned, you know, and I think that's what he's facing at the moment. So he can't go under the radar anymore. He'll start the Tour as number one and one of the favourites. So we'll be watching him in the first week, whereas last year it was all about Froome and watching Froome and Froome's build up. He hasn't got that this year, where he can just go under the radar. You know, everything's been analysed and watched, and that adds a different pressure to it as the Tour winner.
And I think this off season as well probably has been different, because the Tour winner, a lot more demands on him. Maybe that has taken a bit of effect as well on his fitness level in the early part of the season.
On the Grand Tours then, the first one of the season is less than a month away, the Giro d'Italia, Saturday, May the 11th. It begins in Bologna. This year's route features 7 summit finishes, 3 individual time trials, maybe a route that would have suited you, Brad, with the 3 ITTs.
You've still got to get up the climbs, but I mean, obviously that you would think would favour Dumoulin again going into it. Simon Yates has made no secret of his desire to try and rectify what happened last year. He's worked on his time trial, and he's obviously won the time trial in Paris-Nice this year, so he seems to be, you know, on track for that. Plus, his form is ideal, you know, so we spoke about it the last few weeks, and just how perfect he seems to be in position he seems to be in. So it's all lining up well, but obviously you've got Bernal as well, fresh off his Paris-Nice win. You know, he's an immense talent that I'm sure will win the Giro one day. Whether it's too soon to win the Giro this year, it might be a bit too much to expect 3 weeks out of him. But it's going to line up to be a fantastic race. And the Giro, you know, the weather comes with the Giro in May, and, you know, snow. I mean, we see the changes last year. Who'd have thought with a week to go last year that Chris Froome would have won it? Yeah. So it's probably a better race to watch than the Tour.
It's a stacked field, as we said. So I'm going to ask each of you now to pick, we'll start with the Giro, a winner and a dark horse, if you will.
Well, I'm going to go Simon Yates to win with the dark horse of Bernal.
Nice. Matt?
Well, I'm going to go Bernal to win with Dumoulin, my cheeky side bet.
Dumoulin, a dark horse. The lightest of dark horses.
Yeah, I want to say dark horse. I
mean, Samuel or Tom?
It's going to be Tom, not yet. Oh, Sam. Sam, definitely a dark horse if he turns up.
Sean?
Well, the little bit of stage racing that we've seen, notably Paris-Nice, Bernal was very impressive. But as Brad said, the weather conditions, that can change everything in the Giro, because you can have such horrible conditions and you can have such great conditions like we had last year. You know, it was just fabulous weather right through. At the moment, my pick would be Bernal.
And your dark horse?
Tom Dumoulin.
All right, 2 very, very light dark horses in there.
Great minds.
Brad, I want to talk about Big Tom, because you mentioned him last week. And so he's switched his focus from the Tour de France to the Giro. It's a race that he's won before. It's a course, as we mentioned, with the 3 time trials that obviously suits him. Is the decision to switch from focusing on the Tour to focusing on the Giro something you agree with? I mean, because he's going to have a go at both this year as well.
Yeah, I mean, he had a go at both last year, didn't he? I was surprised to see him as good in the Tour last year as he was. You know, it was incredible. It's 2 podium finishes in 2 Grand Tours last year. He's an amazing athlete, really. And I'm surprised he's not gone and had 1 year where he's just focused on the Tour, because he's built for the Tour. And it's amazing he does what he does at the Giro, considering how tough it is. And what he's the type of people he's got to go up against in Simon Yates, etc. Whereas the Tour, you know, the likes of Geraint won the Tour. Tom's a similar rider to Geraint. You know, the climbs suit him better. They're not as steep as the Giro. So, yeah, it is a surprise. I'm not too sure what his motivation for it is. Having already won the Giro, you'd think he'd be branching out to try and win a Tour de France. Or whether he thinks he's got more opportunities at the Giro because Sky have been so dominant when they get into the mountains of the Tour.
Give us your favourite then for the Tour.
Chris Froome.
Matt.
I'm going to go. Well, I said this a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. Froome. I know he hasn't had an ideal run in, but he can just turn it around, I think. And he's got that much experience. I think he's going to be hard to beat. I really do.
You got a dark horse for us?
G.
Geraint.
I think Froome as well said it. I think he's going to, this will be his fifth tour. And my dark horse is someone who's had been in with the shout for the last few years. If he can stay upright, and it's probably his last chance to maybe win the tour, is Richie Porte, because he is running out of time rapidly now. So
he can't seem to stay well. Can't seem to
Well, if we see him in the form he showed in the Dauphiné 2 years ago and in the Tour of Swiss last year, particularly on the climbs, it'd be nice to see that Richie Porte. We know he's capable of it. It's just getting him to that point upright has been the biggest challenge.
Staying on his bike. He's always talked about as a challenger, as sort of, you know.
He must be, is he 36 now? 30, approaching 37 maybe?
I think he might be young, but he's about 34, I think. But he said his years are numbered in terms of challenging for a Grand Tour, definitely.
And it's whether Trek have the firepower to support him at a Tour. Again, this is always going to be the biggest challenge for a lot of these teams is, you know, can any of them challenge Sky in terms of horsepower?
What about the Vuelta, Sean? I mean, it's a long way away at this point. Anything can happen. As we know, it's the guys who tend to go for the Vuelta are the guys who maybe don't do so well at the Tour. And it's sort of their chance to get back what they could have won, almost.
Yes, well, all the Grand Tours are a long ways off. Even the Giro is a long way, because now we're in classic mode, and we're thinking about the Cobber Classics and the Ardennes Classics. So it is early days to start talking about the Giro or the Tour. Vuelta, my God, it's a long, long, long way off. We don't even know who's going to be riding. I don't know. Quintana is the one who always seems to get together for the Vuelta, but he's also focusing on the Tour of France this year, I believe. So, yeah, depending on what way he performs in the Tour, but yeah, for me, if a Quintana focuses a bit on a Vuelta, I think he's a rider that, you know, can do that. He's proven already.
Can we see one of the main men for the Giro bookend their year? So can we see someone doing well at the Giro and then following up by sort of resting over the Tour de France and perhaps coming back?
Someone like Yates.
Definitely,
Yates.
Yeah.
Simon Yates.
I kind of think if things stay the way they are and everything, Froome does win a fifth Tour, G doesn't really get back to the form he was at for the Tour last year, we could see G go into the Vuelta and maybe trying to add the Vuelta title to his. Bearing in mind the World Championships are in Britain straight after that, and it's an opportunity for him to perform or maybe win a World Road title, because that's certainly something G could do on a course like that in Leeds and carry that. And with an outside bet, the oldest man in the world, Alejandro Valverde, for the Vuelta at 49, by then he'll be. He could, you know, as world champion at the Vuelta, he could, you know, he nearly won it last year, did I say nearly won it? He was certainly up there with a couple of days to go.
He's always up there, yeah. Well, we want to know who you think will win the three Grand Tours this year. Please do send us your predictions to Twitter at Eurosport_UK.
Listeners, it's time to tell you a bit more about our sponsor, Lacca. Lacca is a smarter way of ensuring your bike and your gear. It's a community of cyclists joining together to save each other money. Lacca covers all the basics like theft and accidental loss and damage, both at home and abroad. It'll also cover you in sportives and competition races, so long as you're not riding in the pro peloton. How does Lacca work, you ask? Well, instead of charging you a fixed premium, with Lacca you only pay a small share of the community's claims cost, and your share is proportionate to how much you insure. Lacca locks in a maximum price cap to make sure there are no nasty surprises, even in months with lots of claims amongst the community. And when there are no claims that month, you could even pay nothing at all. Rest assured, claims are accepted fast, usually within 24 hours. On average, Lacca's members have saved 61% on bike insurance. So why don't you investigate the benefits for yourself? Find out more at lacca.co.uk and enter the promo code Wiggins to get £10 off. That's laka.co.uk and the promo code WIGGINS.
Now, Lotto Soudal's Belgian time trial specialist Victor Campenaerts is set to take on the hour record this week. The current record is, of course, 54.526 kilometres, set by you, Brad, in 2015. That's what he has to beat in Aguas Calientes, Mexico, when he goes on either Tuesday or Wednesday.
Whatever happens, I'll still have the sea level world record. I'll be like Tyson Fury with this linear world
can't
title.
Can't be beaten.
You end up with.
You think he's going to do it, don't you?
I think if he starts, he'll do it, because you don't start the hour record unless you know you're going to do it, because it's so quantifiable. Mm. You know, the first thing you do is you go and ride 10, 15, 20 minutes at pace and see what it feels like. If that feels all right, you try and do a half an hour trial, maybe a 45 minute trial. He's been working on this for a long, long time with a good team of people around him. He's not gone all the way out there to start it and fail. You know, there is no second place. You either do it or you fail in an hour record. So if he starts, they'll be confident that he's going to break it. And when I was speaking to him back in December, they'd already done 30 minutes at pace and felt comfortable. So yeah. I think he'll break it. As I've said a few times now, I think it'd be good for the sport. It'd be good for the record. We're coming up to nearly 4 years this year that I've had it. And you don't want it to lie dormant for too long like Chris Borman's did. You know, we want the sport to progress and move along and new people to establish records for other people to then come along and break it. So, you know, good luck to him. And I'm sure if he starts it, he'll break it.
Well, he'll be the seventh man to give it a crack since you set the record. So we'll keep our powder dry on that for now, and all going well, we should hopefully hear from Victor on next week's show. But before we come to that, to set the scene for us, I spoke to a rider who has gone to the same velodrome in Aguascalientes and been successful in breaking the UCI hour record, Italian cyclist Vittoria Bussi. She took the women's record in September last year. I began by asking her about why she took the record on in the first place.
I come from actually another sport, which is track and field athletics. I was a runner. So changing to another sport was really difficult because I started cycling at 27 years old. And so I missed all the technicalities to handle the bike properly. So when I started riding a bunch of people, it was really scary. So I couldn't find my way at the beginning in cycling. And then I love time trial because they were very similar to running. So when people said to me, okay, maybe it's good for you the hour because you don't have to change the gear, you don't have to worry about descending, cornering, stay in the peloton, I just like start to Google it and read the story, and was such an epic story, so fascinating that I decided to start training for that.
You've said that Brad was a big inspiration for you for the hour record. Was he the only inspiration, or were there other factors that really pushed you on to do it?
Well, yes, it was really inspiring for me because I really like look at him, like the position and the way he rode on the track. So I was like really studying carefully everything that I could see from the video on the web. And yes, but I think also you need some kind of inspiration, which is out of sport. So an inspiration that you can find from your real life, so outside cycling. And then for me in particular was when I lost my father. That was my main motivation to do something big in my life and live for two people, for me and my father. And also like, when I was doing athletics, it was like really close to me. And so coming back to sport, anagonistic level, was like a way to come back close to him.
Was it difficult to find the motivation to go again? Because you had two cracks at your hour record, didn't you? You rode for 44 minutes on the first time in Aguascalientes, and then you came back less than 48 hours later to have another go, got back on the bike and obviously this time rode for the whole hour and took the record.
Yeah, it was like two very long days because I was really unlucky the first day because as we said before, it's very scientific, the hour. So you need to calculate the air density. And especially in altitude, air density changed a lot. And that day, there was like a kind of heavy rain, no sun. So the velodrome was really cold. And so there was no more the advantage of a thin air density, a lower density. And then at some point, the sun came out. So I decided to have a go. But I wasn't mentally prepared for that because at the beginning I decided to do the day after, and then suddenly I changed my mind and everything happened too fast and I really wasn't prepared for that. So I was like almost on pace, but to break the hour was not enough. So I just couldn't go a little bit stronger because I didn't have the enough motivation that day. And so after 40 minutes, I decided to stop.
What's your memory, Vittoria, of riding the hour? What's your memory of actually being on the track?
Actually, you think about everything except cycling, because if you think that you're pedaling like at 48 km per hour in the velodrome, you need to do like almost 200 laps. It's too much. So your mind cannot support that. So you just think about your thoughts. And I just remember the voice of my boyfriend was shouting to me the lap time, the loud music, because I prepared like a playlist of music, like dancing music, and was really loud in the velodrome. So I just remember the music, the voice of my boyfriend, the sensation of pain at the leg, at the neck, and pain everywhere, actually. So that was my sensation. And also, obviously, the last minute was really emotional, because I understood that I was breaking a world record. So it was really, wow, exciting.
So Victor Campenaerts, the Lotto Soudal rider, is going to have, he's the next person who's going to have a crack at the hour record on either Tuesday or Wednesday this week. It will be in the same velodrome in Aguascalientes as you broke your hour record. Do you have any advice for Victor? What's the one piece of advice you might give him before he gives it a crack?
The main thing for me was try to start not too fast. So because at the beginning you feel easy at the beginning. So the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you want just to go. So the thing is, start regular as possible, and really from the first lap. So don't push too hard, even on the first lap. I mean, it's difficult because you're excited. You're going to try to break a record. So you just want to push. And so the main thing is have the sensation to go slow at the beginning.
Sure, don't go out too hot. Victoria, having fallen in love, as you say, with the hour record, if someone else were now to go and beat your record, do you think that you would go back to it?
Yeah, actually, I'm thinking about trying to break my own record again, because, as I said, I just fall in love with the hour. It's the best effort. So I can think about going back to the hour in maybe next year.
You've got an impressive sort of track record of learning to deal with pain, or teaching yourself to deal with pain and push through that pain barrier. And you said that finding a reason for doing the hour record beyond yourself has helped you to do that and helped you to push through what you previously might have thought your limits were. Tell us about your relationship with pain, or the perception of pain, and how you deal with it.
I remember there was like an evolution in my relation with pain, because at the beginning, when you start training for something so big, so far from your limit, at some point you feel pain. And when you feel pain, like your mind wants to protect your body. So even if your body has more to do, your mind say to you, okay, let's quit because it's too hard. It's hard not just physically, but also like emotionally, because it's like when you do something big, sometimes you want to don't get embarrassed if you fail. So it's kind of protection from your brain. And so I remember that sensation. Okay, my mind is telling me, let's quit as fast as possible. And at the beginning, I was like listening my mind, and I was scared. Oh my God, the pain is going to arrive. What I'm going to do if the pain arrives? I have to stay with the pain for so long. So I was scared about pain. And then I changed my point of view. And I said, okay, I'm preparing a world record. So it's normal that I will feel pain. And it's good if I feel pain, because it means that I'm going through my limits. So I was like searching for pain, actually. It's slightly a change of point of view. But it really changed your relation with pain, because you are searching for him. It's not him that come to you and you're scared. And then when he come and I find the pain, I stay in the pain. And that's the thing that make you feel like alive, because you start to investigate in yourself. You start to speak with your brain. When your brain say, let's quit, you can reply, no, because we are like trying to break a record. And so it's normal. Don't be scared of pain.
And on that note, Victoria, you've got a question for Brad, haven't you?
Yeah. I was like wondering how Bradley's relation with pain evolved in his career. Like for me, for my small career in 3 years, more or less, I changed a lot my relation with pain, which is like in the hour is the maximum expression of pain. So I just was curious to know from the beginning how he deal with pain, how the hour changed his relation with pain, and if he has some if he had some kind of motivation beyond himself that enabled him to push through the limits.
You're listening to The Bradley Wiggins Show from Eurosport.
So, Brad, we know that you were more comfortable than most in that TT position. Vittoria there talked about pushing through the pain. And, you know, no matter how comfortable you are in that position, I think you've still got to be able to push through that pain barrier. So this one comes in two parts, really. How did you manage to push through the pain for that hour record success? And as Vittoria says there, did you have one particular thing driving you?
Yeah, I think they both merge into one for me, really. Yeah. And it was fear of failure. Overriding factor was fear and shame, really. You know, a velodrome full of people, 1.1 million people watching on Sky. You'd built your career up to that point, and you've, you know, 6 months out, I announced I was going to do it on the 6th of June at 6:30 in the evening. And people have paid their hard-earned money to come and watch you. And so the only thing that was really was the fear of failure. You've got 1 hour, you know, and with every 5-10 minutes that went by, you know, it was just, right, you've got 40 minutes left, Brad. Right, you're halfway through now. That's 30 minutes to go. That's 25 minutes. In 20 minutes' time, it's all done and you're going to break the record and everyone's going to go, oh, I'm happy, and it's going to be relief and you can go and have a drink. 10 minutes to go, 15 minutes to go, 10 minutes to go, 8 minutes to go, 7 minutes. That was the only thing. You can't stop now because you're going to look like a right tit, you know? And that's it. That's the only thing driving you. It's the most painful thing in the world, 7 minutes to go. Well, you can't stop. You've got to see it out. 7 minutes, the last thing you ever do on a bike ever again. 7 minutes, 5 minutes to go. Well, you're there now. You've done it. You've done 55 minutes, Brad. Just focus on your line. And that was it. Just fear of failure and sending everyone home happy. The expectation that you'd set yourself up to. That's why we did it in London.
Mm.
We could have done it behind closed doors in altitude and gone and established, you know, the record beyond, you know, or not set a date, you know, like Victor's done. But we announced it 6 months out, sold tickets. It was about the public. It was about putting on an exhibition in the London Velodrome on the site of the Lee Valley Cycle Circuit where I started cycling in Eastway. And it was a commercial thing and a brand thing. And, you know, we did it on that day and it was what it was.
Do you learn to push through the pain? Is that something that comes over your career?
Well, I think when you're in good shape and you've trained for something specifically, I always found, like the Olympics and things, that the pain is quite sweet pain. The pain is quite different to suffering.
Mm.
When you're suffering, I always associate that with you're not up to the task. You know, you haven't got the legs to be doing, so you suffer and it's a horrible pain because you're hanging on. But when you're in good shape and you're the one dishing out, you're hurting just as much, the lactate's the same, but you're just travelling faster than everyone else. And that gives you an adrenaline rush when it happens. So that suffering becomes a sweet pain.
Mm.
It's an enjoyable pain that you want to turn it up more, turn the screw even harder. But when someone's turning the screw on you, you're suffering. That's how I've always viewed the two. Mm. When the form is good, it's a sweet pain. When it's bad, you suffer.
Sean, how did you deal with it? Because of the boil on the bottom aside.
Well, as Brad said, you prepare and you put in the work. And when you're doing the old record, of course, you know, you have your times, your split times, and you know what, you know what you have to ride at. And you have been doing your training sessions, and you know you can do it. So, you know, the confidence is there first. And when the groundwork, the foundation work, the preparation is done, then you know you can do it. And of course, you know, the confidence. When you're up on time, when you're on schedule, then, you know, you can push yourself that much more. It's a different sort of pain.
Mm.
It's like in the classic races or like in a stage race in the mountains. If you're on the front and you're in the front group there and, you know, you're sitting there and you can hear on race radio this rider lashay, and you're sitting comfortable there, then, you know, you get that boost. Although you are suffering, it's a different sort of suffering, it's a different sort of pain. And if you're riding on the front, of course, you know, you're dishing out the pain, as they say in cycling, and, you know, then that feeling is totally different. But if you're hanging on the rear of a group and you're trying to stay there and you lose 3 or 4 bike lengths, that pain is totally different. It's a real killer.
It's a mental torture.
It's a mental, yes. It's a mental torture more.
Is that, you ever get that feeling of, well, if I'm hurting and I'm on the front, then you know fine well that the guy's in just behind you.
Well, sometimes, I always find when you're climbing, that's the best time because you go around a hairpin and everyone does it when they're in the front of the group. They look back down one hairpin and you can normally see the guys that look up. You could just see the desperation and they're just off the back a little bit. And that's when you just accelerate out the hairpin a little bit more and put them. And they're the best places to be, aren't they?
Yeah, you can actually, again, not the same level as the guys either side of me today. But my success, you know, when I was going good, it was very, you know, I used to train exceptionally hard. My kind of psychology was just, I need to learn how to suffer. So when I was in races, a lot of the time I was just rolling through in breaks and stuff, you know, and just knew how to suffer.
Yeah.
But when you're dishing it out, you actually start to, you feed off other people's suffering. You look around, like Brad just said, you look around, you see them suffering behind, and somehow you find even more. And there's a weird, although I'm a pretty laid-back, okay kind of guy, there's a perverse pleasure you get from seeing other riders suffer, and you can really dish it out. And that, and you can get an adrenaline from, it kind of sounds quite sadistic, but there's a, you know, you can feed off the suffering of other riders. And it's a special place to be. You know, it's a rarefied atmosphere. When you're riding at that kind of level, you can't actually seemingly find a limit of kind of hurting yourself. It's really kind of strange. You're just kind of pedaling and pushing and pushing and pushing, but you're able to give more. It is strange, isn't it? But then when the boot's on the other foot, it's a horrible experience. You could be putting out the same power, but when you're the one dishing it out, it's very different to when you're the one receiving it.
I want to go back to briefly get back to Sagan today, because his face told a story when he's trying to hanging on to Gilbert, and you can see them going up the road, and you can just see that he's running out of gas slowly.
Yeah, his face was something that I call the faces of cycling. And when you've been riding for a while, and all these guys will know each other, and when you're a commentator, you know when riders are suffering. You start to look at, you know, body language. You know the guys are riding strongly. You look at you understand how riders pedal in different given situations. You just learn this, and it doesn't take. And you know when riders are suffering. And Peter Sagan had this kind of, it wasn't really a full-on grimace like he was giving it. It's just they had nothing left, and it was like a, you know, there's a little bit of sadness about it. It was just had nothing left, and riders, some riders can hide that, but there was no hiding that. He was a man that was spent, you know, at that particular point.
So take it briefly back to the classics then before we go, because we talked last week about our cycling dream team. You know, if we were a DS, who would we have in as our ultimate rider for the sprints, for the climbs, for the GC man, for the overall? We've had a ton of responses on social media, largely, or a lot of the time, to pick up some of the riders that we didn't mention. Fabian Cancellara was one man who got in touch and said, what about TT and classic hunters?
Well, we had a descender, didn't we, on our list last year, which we never got to. And I had Fabian on my list because I know he flagged it up on my social this week, and what about Insta, me in your tour. And I did have Fabian in. So,
and that's my
Fabian,
fault,
if you're listening.
We skipped past it. So who would you'd have had?
I'd have had
descender,
yeah, or TT for sure.
Yeah,
and my classics without doubt would have been Johan Museo or Sean.
Present company excluded. Classics man, Sean. Who would you pick if you were a DS and you could pick your all-time classics man? Put him on the spot again, Matt. Yes. We might have to go to you first. Tom Bonin. Yeah, Matt.
I could go. Again, I'm not allowed to pick anybody in a room, am I? Because it would be Sean. But someone like Merckx,
yeah.
You know, when you look at how devastatingly strong he was, he won everything, didn't he? Of the modern era, I guess, I mean, it had to be Gilbert now, really, you know, because, you know, winning that, it sets him on another level. He was, you know, world champion, he's won Amstel as well, you know.
There's not many, is there, that have won, obviously, you know, Sean knows, you know, there's not many that have won Lombardy, Flanders, Roubaix, you know.
And a world title, he's just got Milan San Remo to win, and he's got the top set.
Because
Sean, you won all four, didn't you, missing out on Flanders.
Yeah. And I think Gilbert's won Newsblad a couple of times.
Yeah.
Has he won Flèche Wallonne as well? Sure, he's won Flèche Wallonne. I mean, he's won some climbing races, and those races like Roubaix and that. That takes some all-round bike riders to do.
Well, I suppose it's a very broad one. If you look at the classics, and you look at the Cobble classics, and you look at the Ardennes classics, you know, they're totally two different sort of animals, really. And there's not a lot of riders can do both. But if you just look at it from a classic point of view, and the way they ride the race, and you know, if you can, you could be talking here for, many hours about the riders, but you have a sort of a favourite rider that you like the way he rides and that, and for that reason, I would, Tom Bonin would be a rider that, yes, I would say for the classics, he'd be my pick.
Well, that's about it for this episode of the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport. Thanks to our sponsor, Lacquer, bicycle insurance powered by the community. We'll be back next Monday. Until then, you can stay up to date with Brad on his Twitter and Instagram, Brad, at...
So we go.
You can follow Eurosport on Twitter and Instagram at Eurosport_UK, and you can find us on Facebook. Plus, if you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, share, rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice. You can keep up to date with Matt at
At Real Stevens.
Real Stevens, the one and only. Sean will be back on the Home of Cycling. When can we hear you next, Sean?
Next Sunday, Amstel Gold.
For the Gold Race. Superb. For now, thank you to Sean. Thank you to Matt. Apologies to our other guest, Kenny Van Vlaminck. We've run out of time today, Kenny.
It's not normal. I need to speak to the top guy because this is not acceptable. I come here for €15. I need to talk to Sir Wiggins. Also to the Kelly guy. It's a big problem. It's not normal.
Kenny, apologies.
It's a big problem.
We'll talk about it afterwards. Brad, thanks for your time. Enjoy your last few days, possibly as the hour record holder.
I'm just flying out to Colombia now to throw a load of drawing pins down there.
Well, maybe do Mexico as well.
I might do a bit of streaking to disrupt the hour record. I wonder if we'll get a streaker at the hour record.
We might do now.
I think Kenny's flying out, apparently. He's just left.
Is he? He's gone. Finally, from me, Graham Wilgos, it's goodbye. We'll see you next week for a look back at the Amstel Gold Race.
The Bradley Wiggins Show is a Muddy Knees Media production for Eurosport.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.